Therefore, I did not rush up to make friends, but neither did I shrink away. My second day at school, I had to blow my nose, and I had no handkerchief with me. Mary Jane Watkins was sitting next to me, so she quickly shoved her handkerchief in my hand without saying a word. We were in chapel, and Dr. Spencer was up speaking. So she kept her eyes front, I nodded my thanks, and so began a friendship. Bernice Hughes, whose father, Dr. W.A.C. Hughes, was somebody really important in the Methodist Episcopal Church and a trustee of the college, sat watching me after about a week in school. Her gray eyes were fixed on me, and her red lips were puckered in a frown. I did not know what to think, but it was in English history, which I liked very much, and I was not doing badly in recitation. When the period was over and the class passed on to the next room, she fell in beside me and said, "If you ain't one knowing fool, I'm naming you old knowledge bug." Then she laughed that kind of a laugh she has to cover up her feelings, and I laughed too. Bernice can register something that makes you look at her and like her, no matter what she does. "I'm sitting by you tomorrow, fool, and from now on, you hear me?" she went on with her catching laugh. "No use in both of us studying like a fool. You can just study for both of us." So from then on, I was knee-deep in the Hughes family. There is more looks and native ability in the Hughes clan to the square child than any I can think of offhand. If they do not always make a brilliant showing, it is not because they can't do it. Their looks and charm interfere with their brain work, that is all. And you are not going to forget them either. If a Hughes is in town, you are going to know it in one way or another. It soon became apparent that my lack of clothes was no drawback to my getting along. Sometimes somebody would ask me, "Zora, what do you think you'll wear to school tomorrow?" I'd humor the joke and describe what I was going to wear, but let a program or a get-together come along, and all the girls in the class would be backing me off in a corner or writing me notes, offering to lend me something to wear. I would have to take it in rotation to keep from causing hard feelings. I got on with the boys, too. In no time, I made Stanley James a varsity football man. Then it was Douglas Camper, a senior college man. His brother was a football star at Howard University in Washington. Our class had cornered all of the college seniors so that not one college girl was escorted to the senior prom. We just couldn't see how functions like that could go on without our gang. Mary Jane had cornered Ed Wilson, the Clark Gable of the campus, for the occasion, so the Marines had landed. Whenever Miss Clark, our English teacher, was absent, I was put in charge of the class. This happened time and time again, sometimes for a whole week at a time. With history, it was the same. Once I had the history classes for nearly a month and had to be excused from my other classes. At times like that, my classmates were perfectly respectful to me until the bell rang. Then how they would poke fun at my serious face while I was teaching. With Dean Pickens to coach me, I placed second in the school oratorical contest. Rosa Brown placed first and Bernice Hughes third, indicating that our class was determined to be head muckety-muck in everything that went on. My first publication was on the blackboard in the assembly hall at Morgan. I decided to write an allegory using the faculty members as characters. Most of my classmates were in the know. I went to school extra early that morning, and when the bell rang for assembly, the big board was covered with the story. Dr. Spencer, the president of Morgan, had a great shock of curly white hair. He was the kindly great gray bear of the story. Dean Pickens was the ferocious pick. Practically every faculty member was up there to the great entertainment of the student body. Furthermore, we could see the various members of the faculty sneaking peeps at the board over their shoulders from time to time, as the service went on. When Dr. Spencer rose to read from the Bible, his face was as red as a beet under all that white hair. He ran his fingers through his hair 2 or 3 times as he kept looking back at the board. After the short service was over, he commented on it and actually burst out laughing. Then, of course, everybody else could laugh. All except one man who was there to succeed Dean Pickens, who was going to New York to work for the NAACP. This man clouded up and tried to reign. He was up there in the character of Pocket Tooth, and he didn't like it. He had earned that name because his 2 canine teeth were extra long, but sort of square at the ends. My class decided that they looked like the pockets on my dress. So as far as we were concerned, he was Pocket Tooth, and he stayed Pocket Tooth for the duration. He led devotions next morning and dared everybody to write anything like that on the board again. Dean Pickens, for all his ferocious official frown and hot temper, was full of boy. Down in his apartment, Mrs. Pickens ran things, and he played with his 3 children. Ruby, the youngest, seemed to have the inside track with him. I was in and out of the Pickens home every day. I actually heard him discussing with Ruby her chances of licking Harriet, her older sister. She had tried it and failed. Dean Pickens was full of sympathy, but he told her he was afraid Harriet was too tough for her. She had better get even with Harriet some other way. If she felt she must fight, hit Harriet 1 quick lick and run. That was the best advice he could give her. Mrs. Pickens put down her book and looked at her husband just as she would have at Bill, her son. My 2 years at Morgan went off very happily indeed. The atmosphere made me feel right. I was at last doing the things I wanted to do. Every new thing I learned in school made me happy. The science courses were tremendously interesting to me. Perhaps it was because Professor Calloway was such an earnest teacher. I did not do well in mathematics. Why should A minus B? Who the devil was X anyway? I could not even imagine. I still do not know. I passed the courses because Professor Johnson, knowing that I did well in everything else, just made it a rule to give me a C. He probably understood that I am one of those people who have no number sense. I have been told that you can never factor A, B to the place where it comes out even. I wouldn't know because I never tried to find out. When it came time to consider college, I planned to stay on at Morgan, but that was changed by chance. May Miller, daughter of the well-known Dr. Kelly Miller of Howard University, came over to Morgan to spend the weekend with her first cousins, Bernice and Gwendolyn Hughes. So we were thrown together. After a few hours of fun and caper, she said, "Zora, you are Howard material. Why don't you come to Howard?" Now, as everyone knows, Howard University is the capstone of Negro education in the world. There gather Negro money, beauty, and prestige. It is to the Negro what Harvard is to the whites. They say the same thing about a Howard man that they do about Harvard. You can tell a Howard man as far as you can see him, but you can't tell him much. He listens to the doings of other Negro schools and their graduates with bored tolerance. Not only is the scholastic rating at Howard high, but tea is poured in the manor. I had heard all about the swank fraternities and sororities and the clothes and everything, and I knew I could never make it. I told May that. "You can come and live at our house, Zora," Bernice offered. At the time, her parents were living in Washington, and Bernice and Gwendolyn were in the boarding department at Morgan. "I'll ask Mama the next time she comes over. Then you won't have any room and board to pay. We'll all get together and rustle you up a job to make your tuition." So that summer, I moved on to Washington and got a job. First as a waitress in the exclusive Cosmos Club downtown, and later as a manicurist in the G Street shop of Mr. George Robinson. He is a Negro who has a chain of white barber shops in downtown Washington. I managed to scrape together money for my first quarter's tuition and went up to register. Lo and behold, there was Dwight Holmes sitting up there at Howard. He saved my spirits again. I was short of money, and Morgan did not have the Class A rating that it now has. There was trouble for me, and I was just about to give up and call it a day when I had a talk with Dwight Holmes. He encouraged me all he could, and so I stuck and made up all of those hours I needed. I shall never forget my first college assembly, sitting there in the chapel of that great university. I was so exalted that I said to the spirit of Howard, "You have taken me in. I am a tiny bit of your greatness. I swear to you that I shall never make you ashamed of me." It did not wear off. Every time I sat there as part and parcel of things, looking up there at the platform crowded with faculty members, the music, the hundreds of students about me, it would come down on me again. When on Mondays we ended the service by singing Alma Mater, I felt just as if it were the Star-Spangled Banner. Reared against the eastern sky, proudly there on hilltop high, up above the lake so blue, stands old Howard, brave and true. There she stands for truth and right, sending forth her rays of light, clad in robes of majesty. Old Howard, we sing of thee. My soul stood on tiptoe and stretched up to take in all that it meant. So I was careful to do my classwork and be worthy to stand there under the shadow of the hovering spirit of Howard. I felt the ladder under my feet. Mr. Robinson arranged for me to come to work at 3:30 every afternoon and work until 8:30. In that way, I was able to support myself. Soon, most of the customers knew I was a student and tipped me accordingly. I averaged $12 to $15 a week. Mr. Robinson's 1410 G Street shop was frequented by bankers, senators, cabinet members, congressmen, and gentlemen of the press. The National Press Club was one block down the same street. The Treasury Building was one block up the street and the Capitol not far away. I learned things from holding the hands of men like that. The talk was of world affairs, national happenings, personalities, the latest quips from the cloakrooms of Congress and such things. I heard many things from the White House and the Senate before they appeared in print. They probably were bursting to talk to somebody, and I was safe. If I told, nobody would have believed me anyway. Besides, I was much flattered by being told and warned not to repeat what I had heard. Sometimes a senator, a banker, a newspaper correspondent attached to the White House would all be sitting around my table at one time. While I worked on one, the others waited and they all talked. Sometimes they concentrated on teasing me. At other times they talked about what had happened or what they reasoned was bound to happen. Intimate stories about personalities, their secret love affairs, cloakroom retorts, and the like. Soon they took me for granted and would say, "Zora knows how to keep a secret. She's all right." Now, I know that my discretion really didn't matter. They were relieving their pent-up feelings where it could do no harm. Some of them meant more to me than others because they paid me more attention. Frederick William Weil, White House correspondent, used to talk to me at times quite seriously about life and opportunities and things like that. He had seen three presidents come and go. He had traveled with them, to say nothing of his other traveling to and from upon the earth. He had read extensively. Sometimes he would be full of stories and cracks, such as commenting on the wife of an ex-president who had been quite the grand dame when she was first lady. Why, she was so glad when that man proposed to her that she fell out of bed. But at other times he would talk to me quite seriously about attitudes, points of view, why one man was great and another a mere facile politician, and so on. There were other prominent members of the press who would sit and talk longer than it took me to do their hands. One of them, knowing that certain others sat around and talked, wrote out questions two or three times for me to ask and tell him what was said. Each time, the questions were answered, but I was told to keep that under my hat, and so I had to turn around and lie and say the man didn't tell me. I never realized how serious it was until he offered me $25 to ask a certain Southern congressman something and let him know as quickly as possible. He sent out and bought me a quart of French ice cream to bind the bargain. The man came in on his regular time, which was next day, and in his soft voice began to tell me how important it was to be honorable at all times and to be trustworthy. How could I ask him then? Besides, he was an excellent Greek scholar and translated my entire lesson for me, which was from Xenophon's Cyropaedia, and talked at length on the ancient Greeks and Persians. The newsman was all right. He had to get his information the best way he could, but for me, it would have been terrible to do that nice man like that. I told the reporter how it was, and he understood and never asked me again. Mr. Johns, a pressman, big, slow, with his eternal walking stick, was always looking for a laugh. Logan, our head porter, was his regular meat. Logan had a long head, so flat on each side that it looked like it had been pressed between two planks. His toes turned in, and his answers were funny. One day, while shining Mr. John's shoes, he told him what a fighter he was. He really was tough when he got mad, according to himself. According to Logan, Logan was mean. Just couldn't help it. He had Indian blood in him, just mean and strong. When he straightened out his African soup bone, arm, something was just bound to fall. If a man didn't fall when he hit him, he went around behind him to see what was propping him up. Yes, sir. Mr. Johns listened at Logan and smiled. He egged him on to tell more of his powers. The very next day, Mr. Johns came in and announced that they had a bear up at Keith's Theater, and they needed somebody to wrestle with him. There was good money in it for the man who would come right forward and wrestle with that bear, and knowing that Logan needed money and that he was fearless, he had put Logan's name down. He liked Logan too well to let him get cheated out of such a swell chance to get rich and famous. All Logan needed to do was to go to the theater and tell them that Mr. Johns sent him. "Naw, sir, Mr. Johns," Logan said. "I ain't wrestling no bear. Naw, sir." "But Logan, you told me, everybody in here heard you, that when you get mad, you go bear hunting with your fist. You don't even have to hunt this bear. He's right up there on the corner waiting for you. You can't let me down like this. I've already told the man you would be glad to wrestle his old bear." "How big is that bear, Mr. Johns?" "Oh, he's just a full-grown bear, Logan. Nothing to worry about at all. He wouldn't weigh more than 200 pounds at the outside. Soft snap for a man like you, and you weigh about that yourself, Logan."
"Naw, sir. Not no big bear like that. Naw, sir."
"Well, Logan, what kind of bear would you consider? You just tell me, and I'll fix it up with the man."
"Give me a little bitty baby bear, Mr. Johns. About 3 months old. That's the kind of bear I wants to wrestle with. Yes, sir."
The mental picture of a big, long-armed, awkward six-footer like Logan wrestling with a tiny cub was too much for the shop. Dignity of every sort went out of the window. The bear cycle took on. Every day, important men high in life came in with suggestions on the wrestle. It kept up until Logan furnished them with another laugh by getting into jail over the weekend for beating his wife about a hog head. He thought she had given a pimp the ears off of that head, and found out after he was in jail that it had no ears when he bought it. Mr. Johns went down and persuaded the judge to let Logan go. And then Logan, in a burst of goodwill, offered to give the judge the hog head, still uncooked. The judge chased Logan out of the court, and that hog head became a classic around the shop. An incident happened that made me realize how theories go by the board when a person's livelihood is threatened. A man, a Negro, came into the shop one afternoon and sat down in Banks's chair. Banks was the manager and had the first chair by the door. It was so surprising that for a minute, Banks just looked at him and never said a word. Finally, he found his tongue and asked,
"What do you want?"
"Haircut and shave," the man said belligerently. "But you can't get no haircut and shave here. Mr. Robinson has a fine shop for Negroes on U Street near 15th, Banks told him. "I know it, but I want one here. The Constitution of the United States." But by that time, Banks had him by the arm, not roughly, but he was helping him out of his chair nevertheless. "I don't know how to cut your hair," Banks objected. "I was trained on straight hair. Nobody in here knows how."
"Oh, don't hand me that stuff," the crusader snarled. "Don't be such an Uncle Tom."
"Run on, fella. You can't get waited on in here."
"I'll stay right here until I do. I know my rights. Things like this have got to be broken up. I'll get waited on, all right, or sue the place."
"Go ahead and sue," Banks retorted. "Go on uptown and get your hair cut, man. Don't be so hard-headed for nothing."
"I'm getting waited on right here."
"You're next, Mr. Powell," Banks said to a waiting customer. "Sorry, mister, but you better go on uptown."
"But I have a right to be waited on wherever I please," the Negro said, and started towards Updike's chair, which was being emptied.
Updike whirled his chair around so that he could not sit down and stepped in front of it.
"Don't you touch my chair," Updike glared. "Go on about your business."
But instead of going, he made to get into the chair by force.
"Don't argue with him. Throw him out of here," somebody in the back cried. And in a minute, barbers, customers all lathered and with hair half cut, and porters were all helping to throw the Negro out.
The rush carried him way out into the middle of G Street and flung him down. He tried to lie there and be a martyr, but the roar of oncoming cars made him jump up and scurry off. We never heard any more about it. I did not participate in the melee, but I wanted him thrown out too. My business was threatened. It was only that night in bed that I analyzed the whole thing and realized that I was giving sanction to Jim Crow, which theoretically I was supposed to resist. But here were 10 Negro barbers, 3 porters, and 2 manicurists, all stirred up at the threat of our living through loss of patronage. Nobody thought it out at the moment. It was an instinctive thing. That was the first time it was called to my attention that self-interest rides over all sorts of lives. I have seen the same thing happen hundreds of times since, and now I understand it. One sees it breaking over racial, national, religious, and class lines. Anglo-Saxon against Anglo-Saxon, Jew against Jew. Negro against Negro, and all sorts of combinations of the three against other combinations of the three. Offhand, you might say that we 15 Negroes should have felt the racial thing and served him. He was one of us. Perhaps it would have been a beautiful thing if Banks had turned to the shop crowded with customers and announced that this man was going to be served like everybody else, even at the risk of losing their patronage, with all of the other employees lined up in the center of the floor shouting, "So say we all." It would have been a stirring gesture and made the headlines for a day. Then we could all have gone home to our unpaid rents and bills and things like that. I could leave school and begin my wanderings again. The militant Negro, who would have been the cause of it all, would have perched on the smuddled-up wreck of things and crowed. Nobody ever found out who or what he was. Perhaps he did what he did on the spur of the moment, not realizing that serving him would have ruined Mr. Robinson, another Negro who had got what he had the hard way. For not only would the G Street shop have been forced to close, but the F Street shop and all of his other six downtown shops. Wrecking George Robinson like that on a race angle would have been an ironic tragedy. He always helped out any Negro who was trying to do anything progressive as far as he was able. He had no education himself, but he was for it. He would give any Howard University student a job in his shops if they could qualify, even if it was only a few hours a week. So I do not know what was the ultimate right in this case. I do know how I felt at the time. There is always something fiendish and loathsome about a person who threatens to deprive you of your way of making a living. That is just human-like, I reckon. At the university, I got on well both in classwork and the matter of making friends. I could not take in but so many social affairs because I had to work, and then I had to study my lessons after work hours at night, and I was carrying a heavy program. The teacher who most influenced me was Dr. Lorenzo Dow Turner, head of the English department. He was tall, lean, with a head of wavy black hair above his thin, aesthetic, tan-colored face. He was a Harvard man and knew his subject. His delivery was soft and restrained. The fact that he looked to be in his late 20s or early 30s at most made the girls conscious of shiny noses before they entered his classroom. Listening to him, I decided that I must be an English teacher and lean over my desk and discourse on the 18th century poets and explain the roots of the modern novel. Children just getting born were going to hear about Addison, Poe, De Quincey, Steele, Coleridge, Keats, and Shelley from me, leaning nonchalantly over my desk. Defoe, Burns, Swift, Milton, and Scott were going to be sympathetically but adequately explained, with just that suspicion of a smile now and then, before I returned to my notes. The man who seemed to me to be most overpowering was E.C. Williams, librarian and head of the Romance Language Department. He was cosmopolitan and world-traveled. His wit was instant and subtle. He was so inaccessible in a way, too. He told me once that a flirtation with a co-ed was to him like playing with a teething ring. He liked smart, sophisticated women. He used to lunch every day with E.D. Davis, head of the Greek and German department. Davis was just the antithesis of Williams, so shy, in the Charles S. Johnson manner, in spite of his erudition. They would invite me to come along and would pay for my milk and pie. Williams did most of the talking. I put in something now and then. Davis sat and smiled. Professor Williams egged me on to kiss him. He said that Davis would throw a fit and he wanted to be present to see it. He whispered that Davis liked to have me around, but from what he ever said, I couldn't notice. When I was sick, Professor Davis came to see me and brought me an armload of roses, but he sat there half an hour and scarcely said a word. He just sat there and smiled now and then. One day, a pretty Washington girl visited me on the campus and joined us at lunch. She laid down a heavy barrage around E.C. Williams. He leaned back in his chair in the midst of her too obvious play and said suddenly, "Girlie, you would flirt with the Pope." She was taken aback and turned a melting smile upon Davis and colored. "You wouldn't say that about me, would you, Professor Davis?"
"No. I'd say the only reason you wouldn't flirt with the Pope is that he is so hard to get to."
That floored us. Davis talking up like that? Then he shut up in his shell again. All in all, I did a year and a half of work at Howard University. I would have done the 2 full years, but I was out on account of illness, and by the time that was over, I did not have the money for my tuition. I joined the Zeta Phi Beta sorority, took part in all the literary activities on the campus, and made the Stylus, the small literary society on the Hill. I named the student paper the Hilltop. The Stylus was limited to 19 members, 2 of them being faculty members. Dr. Alain Leroy Locke was the presiding genius, and we had very interesting meetings. My joining the Stylus influenced my later moves. On account of a short story which I wrote for the Stylus, Charles S. Johnson, who was just then founding Opportunity Magazine, wrote to me for material. He explained that he was writing to all of the Negro colleges with the idea of introducing new writers and new material to the public. I sent on Drenched in Light, and he published it. Later, he published my second story, Spunk. He wrote me a kind letter and said something about New York. So, beginning to feel the urge to write, I wanted to be in New York. This move on the part of Dr. Johnson was the root of the so-called Negro Renaissance. It was his work, and only his hush-mouth nature has caused it to be attributed to many others. The success of Opportunity Award dinners was news. Later on, the best of this material was collected in a book called The New Negro and edited by Dr. Alain Locke. But it was the same material for the most part, gathered and published by Dr. Charles Spurgeon Johnson, now of the Department of Social Sciences, Fisk University, Nashville, Tennessee. Being out of school for lack of funds and wanting to be in New York, I decided to go there and try to get back in school in that city. So the first week of January 1925 found me in New York with $1.50, no job, no friends, and a lot of hope. The Charles Johnsons befriended me as best they could. I could always find something to eat out at their house. Mrs. Johnson would give me car fare and encouragement. I came to worship them, really, and when we had a misunderstanding, it grew out of my intense loyalty to them. A certain woman knew how I felt and persuaded me to do something to protect them, which she knew would hurt. Then she doubled right back and prepared them for my perfidy. She had her own plans all worked out what to do about the schism. I saw that they believed her, so I just let it go, as much as it hurt me inside. I have never ceased to regret it, nor had the sense to tell them just what happened. So I came to New York through Opportunity, and through Opportunity to Barnard. I won a prize for a short story at the first award dinner, May 1st, 1925, and Fanny Hurst offered me a job as her secretary, and Annie Nathan Meyer offered to get me a scholarship to Barnard. My record was good enough, and I entered Barnard in the fall, graduating in 1928. I have no lurid tales to tell of race discrimination at Barnard. I made a few friends in the first few days. Eleanor Beer, who lived on the next chair to me in economics, was the first. She was a New York girl, with a sumptuous home down in West 71st Street near the Hudson. She invited me down often, and her mother set out to brush me up on good manners. I learned a lot of things from them. They were well-traveled and cosmopolitan. I found out about forks, who entered a room first, sat down first, and who offered to shake hands. A great deal more of material like that. These people are still lying very close to my heart. I was invited to Eleanor's wedding when she married Enzo de Chatelet, a Swiss mining engineer. But I was down in Florida at the time. So I sent her a hat box full of orange blossoms for the occasion, so she could know how I felt. The social register crowd at Barnard soon took me up, and I became Barnard's sacred black cow. If you had not had lunch with me, you had not shot from tall. I was secretary to Fanny Hurst and living at her 67th Street duplex apartment, so things were going very well with me. Because my work was top-heavy with English, political science, history, and geology, my advisor at Barnard recommended fine arts, economics, and anthropology for cultural reasons. I started in under Dr. Gladys Reichard, had a term paper called to the attention of Dr. Franz Boas, and thereby gave up my dream of leaning over a desk and explaining Addison and Steele to the sprouting generations. I began to treasure up the words of Dr. Reichard, Dr. Ruth Benedict, and Dr. Boas, the King of Kings. That man can make people work the hardest with just a look or a word of anybody else in creation. He is idolized by everybody who takes his orders. We all call him Papa, too. One day I burst into his office and asked for Papa Franz, and his secretary gave me a look and told me I had better not let him hear me say that. Of course, I knew better. But at a social gathering of the Department of Anthropology at his house a few nights later, I brought it up.
"Of course Zora is my daughter, certainly," he said with a smile. "Just one of my missteps, that's all."
The saber cut on his cheek, which it is said he got in a duel at Heidelberg, lifted in a smile. Away from his office, Dr. Boas is full of youth and fun and abhors dull, stodgy arguments. Get to the point is his idea. Don't raise a point which you cannot defend. He wants facts, not guesses, and he can pin you down so expertly that you soon lose the habit of talking all over your face. Either that, or you leave off anthropology. I had the same feeling at Barnard that I did at Howard, only more so. I felt that I was highly privileged and determined to make the most of it. I did not resolve to be a grind, however, to show the white folks that I had brains. I took it for granted that they knew that. Else why was I at Barnard? Not everyone who cries, "Lord, Lord," can enter those sacred iron gates. In her high scholastic standards, equipment, the quality of her student body and graduates, Barnard has a right to the first line of alma mater. Beside the waters of the Hudson, our alma mater stands serene. Dean Gildersleeve has that certain touch. We know there are women's colleges that are older, but not better ones. So I set out to maintain a good average, take part in whatever went on, and just be a part of the college like everybody else. I graduated with a B record, and I am entirely satisfied. Mrs. Meyer, who was the moving spirit in founding the college and who is still a trustee, did nobly by me in getting me in. No matter what I might do for her, I would still be in her debt. 2 weeks before I graduated from Barnard, Dr. Boas sent for me and told me that he had arranged a fellowship for me. I was to go south and collect Negro folklore. Shortly before that, I had been admitted to the American Folklore Society. Later, while I was in the field, I was invited to become a member of the American Ethnological Society. And shortly after, the American Anthropological Society. Booker T. Washington said once that you must not judge a man by the heights to which he has risen, but by the depths from which he came. So to me, these honors meant something, insignificant as they might appear to the world. It was a long step for the waif of Eatonville. From the depth of my inner heart, I appreciated the fact that the world had not been altogether unkind to Mama's child. While in the field, I drove to Memphis, Tennessee, and had a beautiful reconciliation with Bob, my oldest brother and his family. We had not seen each other since I ran off to be a lady's maid. He said that it had taken him a long time to realize what I was getting at. He regretted deeply that he had not been of more service to me on the way. My father had been killed in an automobile accident during my first year at Morgan, and Bob talked to me about his last days. In reality, my father was the baby of the family. With my mother gone and nobody to guide him, life had not hurt him, but it had turned him loose to hurt himself. He had been miserable over the dispersion of his children when he came to realize that it was so. We were all so sorry for him instead of feeling bitter as might have been expected. Old Maker had left out the steering gear when he gave Papa his talents. In Memphis, my brother Ben was doing well as a pharmacist and owner of the East Memphis drugstore. Between his dogs, his wife, his store, and his car, he was quite the laughing, witty person, and I was glad that he was. We talked about Clifford Joel, who had become and still is principal of the Negro High School in Decatur, Alabama, and I told him about seeing John in Jacksonville, Florida, where he was doing well with his market. I had the latest news for them on Everett, Mama's baby child, in the post office in Brooklyn, New York. Dick, the lovable, the irresponsible, was having a high heel time up and down the east coast of the United States. He had never cared about school, but he had developed into a chef cook and could always take care of himself. Sarah was struggling along with a husband for whom we all wished a short sickness and a quick funeral. It was a most happy interval for me. I drove back to New Orleans to my work in a glowing aura. I felt the warm embrace of kin and kind for the first time since the night after my mother's funeral, when we had huddled about the organ, all sodden and bewildered, with the walls of our home suddenly blown down. On September 18th, that house had been a hovering home. September 19th, it had turned into a bleak place of desolation with unknown dangers creeping upon us from unseen quarters that made of us a whimpering huddle, though then we could not see why. But now, that was all over. We could touch each other in the spirit, if not in the flesh. Chapter 10. Research. Research is formalized curiosity. It is poking and prying with a purpose. It is a seeking that he who wishes may know the cosmic secrets of the world and they that dwell therein. 2 weeks before I graduated from Barnard College, Dr. Boaz had arranged a fellowship for me. I was to go south and do research in folklore. I was extremely proud that Papa Franz felt like sending me. As is well known, Dr. Franz Boaz of the Department of Anthropology of Columbia University is the greatest anthropologist alive for two reasons. The first is his insatiable hunger for knowledge, and then more knowledge. And the second is his genius for pure objectivity. He has no pet wishes to prove. His instructions are to go out and find what is there. He outlines his theory, but if the facts do not agree with it, he would not warp a jot or dot of the findings to save his theory. So knowing all this, I was proud that he trusted me. I went off in a vehicle made out of Corona stuff. My first 6 months were disappointing. I found out later that it was not because I had no talents for research, but because I did not have the right approach. The glamour of Barnard College was still upon me. I dwelt in marble halls. I knew where the material was, all right, but I went about asking in carefully accented Barnardese, "Pardon me, but do you know any folk tales or folk songs?" The men and women who had whole treasuries of material just seeping through their pores looked at me and shook their heads. No, they had never heard of anything like that around there. Maybe it was over in the next county. Why didn't I try over there? I did and got the self-same answer. Oh, I got a few little items. But compared with what I did later, not enough to make a flea a waltzing jacket. Considering the mood of my going south, I went back to New York with my heart beneath my knees and my knees in some lonesome valley. I stood before Papa Franz and cried salty tears. He gave me a good going over, but later I found that he was not as disappointed as he let me think. He knew I was green and feeling my oats, and that only bitter disappointment was going to purge me. It did. What I learned from him then and later stood me in good stead when Godmother, Mrs. R. Osgood Mason, set aside $200 a month for a 2-year period for me to work. My relations with Godmother were curious. Laugh if you will, but there was and is a psychic bond between us. She could read my mind, not only when I was in her presence, but thousands of miles away. Both Max Eastman and Richmond Bart have told me that she could do the same with them. But the thing that delighted her was the fact that I was her only godchild who could read her thoughts at a distance. Her old fingers were cramped and she could not write, but in her friend Cornelia Chapin's exact script, a letter would find me in Alabama or Florida or in the Bahama Islands and lay me by the heels for what I was thinking. "You have broken the law," it would accuse sternly. "You are dissipating your powers in things that have no real meaning, and go on to lacerate me. Keep silent. Does a child in the womb speak?" She was just as pagan as I. She had lived for years among the Plains Indians and had collected a beautiful book of Indian lore. Often, when she wished to impress upon me my garrulity, she would take this book from the shelf and read me something of Indian beauty and restraint. Sometimes I would feel like a rabbit at a dog convention. She would invite me to dinner at her apartment, 399 Park Avenue, and then she, Cornelia Chapin, and Miss Chapin's sister, Mrs. Catherine Garrison Biddle, would all hem me up and give me what for. When they had given me a proper straightening and they felt that I saw the light, all the sternness would vanish and I would be wrapped in love. A present of money from Godmother, a coat from Miss Chapin, a dress from Mrs. Biddle. We had a great deal to talk about because Cornelia Chapin was a sculptor, Catherine Biddle a poet, and Godmother an earnest patron of the arts. Then, too, she was godmother to Miguel Covarrubias and Langston Hughes. Sometimes all of us were there. She has several paintings by Covarrubias on her walls. She summoned us when one or the other of us returned from our labors. Miguel and I would exhibit our movies, and Godmother and the Chapin family, including Brother Paul Chapin, would praise us and pan us according as we had done. Godmother could be as tender as mother love when she felt that you had been right spiritually. But anything, however clever in you, that felt like insincerity to her, called forth her well-known, "That is nothing! It has no soul in it! You have broken the law!" Her tongue was a knout, cutting off your outer pretenses and bleeding your vanity like a rusty nail. She was merciless to a lie, spoken, acted, or insinuated. She was extremely human. There she was, sitting up there at the table over capon, caviar, and gleaming silver, eager to hear every word on every phase of life on a sawmill job. I must tell the tales, sing the songs, do the dances, and repeat the raucous sayings and doings of the Negro farthest down. She is altogether in sympathy with them, because she says, truthfully, they are utterly sincere in living. My search for knowledge of things took me into many strange places and adventures, My life was in danger several times. If I had not learned how to take care of myself in these circumstances, I could have been maimed or killed on most any day of the several years of my research work. Primitive minds are quick to sunshine and quick to anger. Some little word, look, or gesture can move them either to love or to sticking a knife between your ribs. You just have to sense the delicate balance and maintain it. In some instances, there is nothing personal in the killing. The killer wishes to establish a reputation as a killer, and you'll do as a sample. Some of them go around making their announcements in singing. I'm going to make me a graveyard of my own. I'm going to make me a graveyard of my own. Oh, carried me down on the smoky road, brought me back on the cooling board. But I'm going to make me a graveyard of my own. And since the law is lax on these big sawmill, turpentine, and railroad jobs, there is a good chance that they never will be jailed for it. All of these places have plenty of men and women who are fugitives from justice. The management asks no questions. They need help and they can't be bothered looking for a bug under every chip. In some places, the law is forbidden to come on the premises to hunt for malefactors who did their malefacting elsewhere. The wheels of industry must move, and if these men don't do the work, who is there to do it? So if a man or a woman has been on the gang for petty thieving and mere mayhem, and is green with jealousy of the others who did the same amount of time for a killing and had something to brag about, why not look around for an easy victim and become a hero, too? I was nominated like that once in Polk County, Florida, and the only reason that I was not elected was because a friend got in there and staved off old club-footed death. Polk County, ah, where the water tastes like cherry wine, where they fell great trees with axe and muscle. These poets of the swinging blade, the brief but infinitely graceful dance of body and axe head, as it lifts over the head in a fluid arc, dances in air, and rushes down to bite into the tree, all in beauty, where the logs march into the mill with its smokestacks, disputing with the elements, its boiler room reddening the sky, and its great circular saw screaming arrogantly as it attacks the tree like a lion making its kill. The log on the carriage coming to the saw, a growling grumble, then contact, yield, whoa! And a board is laid shining anew on a pile. All day, all night, rumble, thunder, and grumble. Yee-ow! Sweating black bodies, muscled like gods, working to feed the hunger of the great tooth. Polk County. Polk County. Black men laughing and singing. They go down in the phosphate mines and bring up the wet dust of the bones of prehistoric monsters to make rich land in far places so that people can eat. But all of it is not dust. Huge ribs, 20 feet from belly to backbone, some old-time sea monster caught in the shallows in that morning when God said, "Let's make some more dry land." Stay there, great Leviathan. Stay there as a memory and a monument to time. Shark teeth as wide as the hand of a working man. Joints of backbone 3 feet high, bearing witness to the mighty monster of the deep when the painted land rose up and did her first dance with the morning sun. Gazing on these relics, 40,000 years old and more, one visualizes the great surrender to chance and change when these creatures were rocked to sleep and slumber by the birth of land. Polk County. Black men from tree to tree among the lordly pines. A swift, slanting stroke to bleed the trees for gum, paint, explosives, marine stores, flavors, perfumes, tone for a violin bow, and many other things which the black men who bleed the trees never heard about. Polk County. The clang of 9-pound hammers on railroad steel. The world must ride.
Ha!
A rhythmic swing of the body, hammer falls, and another spike driven to the head in the tie.
Oh, Mobile. Hank! Oh, Alabama! Hank! Oh, Fort Myers! Hank! Oh, in Florida! Hank! Oh, let's shake it! Hank! Oh, let's break it! Hank! Oh, let's shake it! Hank! Oh, just a hair! Hank!
The singing liner cuts short his chant. The straw boss relaxes with a gesture of his hand. Another rail spiked down. Another offering to the soul of civilization, whose other name is travel.
Evelina, make your dress a little longer. Hark! Oh, Evelina, make your dress a little longer. Hark! I see your thighs. Lord, Lord, I see your thighs. Oh, Angeline. Oh, Angeline. Oh, Angeline, that great, great gal of mine. And when she walks, and when she walks, and when she walks, she rocks and rolls behind. You feel her legs. You feel her legs. You feel her legs, then you want to feel her thighs.
Polk County. Black men scrambling up ladders into orange trees, singing, laughing, cursing, boasting of last night's love, and looking forward to the darkness again. They do not say embrace when they mean that they slept with a woman. A behind is a behind and not a form. Nobody says anything about incompatibility when they mean it does not suit. No bones are made about being fed up. I got up this morning and I knowed I didn't want it, 'cause I slept last night with my hand all on it. Yay, Polk County. You don't know Polk County like I do. Anybody been there tell you the same thing too. Hey, rider, rider, Polk County where the water tastes like cherry wine. Polk County. After dark, the Jooks. Songs are born out of feelings with an old beat-up piano or a guitar for a midwife. Love made and unmade. Who put out that lie? It was supposed to last forever. Love is when it is. No more here, plenty more down the road. Take you where I'm going, woman? Hell no. Let every town furnish its own. Yeah, I'm going. Who care anything about no train fare? The railroad track is there, ain't it? I can count ties just like I've been doing. I can ride the blind, can't I? Got on the train, didn't have no fare, but I rode some. Yes, I rode some. Got on the train, didn't have no fare. Conductor asked me what I'm doing there, but I rode some. Yes, I rode some. Well, he grabbed me by the collar and he led me to the door, but I rode some. Yes, I rode some. Well, he grabbed me by the collar and he led me to the door. He wrapped me over the head with a 44, but I rode some. Yes, I rode some. Polk County in the Jukes, dancing the square dance, dancing the scrouch, dancing the belly rub, knocking the right hat off the wrong head and backing it up with a switchblade. Fan foot, what you doing with my man's hat cocked on your nappy head? I know you want to see your Jesus. Who's a whore? Yeah, I sleeps with my men's, but they pays me. I wouldn't be a fan foot like you, just on the road somewhere, runs up and down the road from job to job making paydays and don't get a thing for but wet drawers. You kiss my black independent money-making ass. Fool with me and I'll cut all your holes into one. Don't nobody hold her. Let her jump on me. She pay her way on me and I'll pay it off. Make time in old Bartow jail for her. Maybe somebody stops the fight before the two switchblades go together. Maybe nobody can. A short, swift dash in, a lucky jab by one opponent, and the other one is dead. Maybe one gets a chill in the feet and leaps out of the door. Maybe both get cut badly and back off. Anyhow, the fun of the place goes on. More dancing and singing and buying of drinks, parched peanuts, fried rabbit. Full drummy bass from the piano with weepy, intricate right-hand stuff. Singing the memories of Ella Wall, the queen of love in the Jukes of Polk County. Ella Wall, Plowchita, nothing Liza. Honey, let your draws hang low. It is a sad parting song. Each verse ends up with, "It's the last time shaking into bed with you." More dancing, drinks, peanuts, singing. Roll me with your stomach, baby. Feed me with your